Hello, here's your KVNF regional newscast for Tuesday, March 7th. A measure to increase Colorado's fine for texting and driving passed a hurdle on the Senate floor last Thursday after a short debate. Benta Berkland reports.
Currently, if you're pulled over by a state trooper for texting and driving, the fine is $50 and 1 point on your license. Under a new bill, the penalty would increase to $300 and 4 points on your license.
We're going to fine you, and we're going to fine you for putting every single other person's life on the road in danger.
That's Senator Owen Hill, a Colorado Springs Republican. He helped broker a compromise on the Democratic bill. If people text in their cars while waiting in traffic or stopped at a light, it wouldn't be a crime. Others, like Senator Randy Baumgartner, a Republican from Hot Sulphur Springs, raised concerns about the proposed cost of the fine and wondered if texting and driving is the only problem.
I'm not saying that you should text and drive. Maybe we should talk about putting makeup on or eating a sandwich.
The Colorado State Patrol says people are addicted to cell phones and that distracted driving is one of the top causes of accidents and traffic fatalities. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
Police-related shootings are on the rise in Colorado. Eric Galatis has this story.
The number of shootings involving police in Colorado is on the rise, almost doubling between 2011 and 2015, and only one officer died during those encounters compared to 132 civilians killed. That's according to a new report mandated by a state law passed in 2015. It created uniform rules for documenting officer-involved shootings, and spokesperson Crystal McCoy says the Aurora Police Department supports the measure.
I think it enhances transparency for the public. It doesn't hinder us in any way, shape, or form. It hasn't created any complications. It's not difficult.
Former State Senator Ellen Roberts, who co-sponsored the original bill, told the University of Colorado News Corps it should help the state identify issues that need to be addressed. But participation is lagging. Some 279 agencies statewide meet the law's reporting requirements. Only 75 submitted reports, up from 48 agencies the previous year. While the officers in only 10% of police-involved shootings were Hispanic, 29% of civilians involved were Hispanic. Alexandra Alonzo with CLARO, the Colorado Latino Leadership Advocacy and Research Organization, says it's evidence of the gap between minority communities and police that both sides are working to bridge.
You know, there's not a lot of building of relationships between police officers and the community members. People see a police officer for the uniform and not for the human that lives there.
Alonzo adds Denver's police department has held meetings with organizations like CLARO and Black Lives Matter.
Looking at the other side of that lens, there were a lot of community members who showed up and said, you know, police officers are not meeting us where we are. There's not enough dialogue.
Alonzo says CLARO is also working to build a program that connects young people with police. The annual report on officer-involved shootings is compiled by the Colorado Department of Public Safety. This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection. This story was produced with original reporting from Stephanie Cook of CU News Corps at the University of Colorado, Boulder.
In his address to Congress last month, President Trump restated his campaign promise to put coal miners back to work. For Inside Energy, Dan Boyce reports that Trump will issue executive orders this week, hoping to do just that.
The executive actions anticipated here soon would do two main things: overturn an Obama administration moratorium on leasing coal on federal land, and start the process of rewriting Obama's signature environmental legacy, the Clean Power Plan, presumably to roll back the plan's restrictions on carbon emissions from power plants. Last year, we spoke with Gail Japp. She's a coal miner in Gillette, Wyoming. She's 65. We visited her windy home outside town shortly after she and hundreds of others were laid off from coal giant Peabody Energy.
So, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's been devastating.
Talk with her now, though?
Hello?
With Trump in office, especially with this upcoming executive order, she feels better.
It's wonderful.
She's working again, running a really big coal truck.
The tires are as tall as a two-story building.
It's a temp job, not like what she used to have. But she is bullish. When I ask her if she thinks Trump's actions specifically will lead her back to full-time work in the next, say, year or two?
I want to know the truth. I think it's going to be a lot sooner than that.
More like a few months.
I think within the next 6 months I'll be back full-time.
Personally, I hope that's the case for her.
That is Rob Godby.
I'm the director for the Center for Energy Economics and Public Policy at the University of Wyoming.
Talking to him about whether things are looking up for coal, well, there are a lot of factors.
Coal has a lot of uncertainty.
But one factor he is pretty certain about, looking at what is determining coal markets right now.
Regulations really aren't making a huge difference.
So let's look at the executive orders expected from President Trump. Overturning the federal moratorium on coal leases. It would happen immediately after the order's release. So ask Godby what effect that's going to have.
No effect.
Now, the BLM points to about 30 projects potentially affected by the moratorium, but Godby says he doesn't know of any just waiting to get started again if it's dropped. Because cheap natural gas is the biggest thing holding coal down. Wind and solar are up there, too.
Renewables have become much more competitive.
Also, since the Great Recession, we've seen a lot more energy-efficient products like TVs and light bulbs.
While the economy started growing again, electricity demand didn't, and that just made everything worse for coal.
The U.S. Energy Information Administration says American power generation from coal peaked in 2011. Since then, the equivalent of about 71 coal power plants have been taken offline, leaving about 400 coal plants in the U.S. today.
Unless people start building more coal-fired power plants, long-term, coal demand really doesn't have anywhere to go.
Things continue to look really bad for Appalachia. Lost jobs, closing mines. There are some bright spots for coal in other parts of the country, though, like Wyoming, where Gale Japp works. The EIA says production nationally is expected to climb 5% overall by next year, because natural gas prices are expected to go up a little bit. And if Trump guts the Clean Power Plan, the short-term effects won't be big. But look out further, say to 2030. Godby says coal production in Wyoming's Powder River Basin is predicted to be nearly 40% higher without the CPP. Sounds like a lot. But to give a sense of just how far coal has fallen,
that production total in 2030 would be the same as what the production total in the Powder River Basin was around 2011.
Leaving a lot of coal miners still in need of a job right now. Gale Japp, she'll work nights, 12-hour days. She can handle it.
Well, for what they pay me, I dang sure can.
For Inside Energy, I'm Dan Boyce.
And that was your KVNF regional newscast for Tuesday. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks for listening.